Hi, everybody. This is Brian Drew, along with
Jared Whitley.
How's it going, everybody? This is a little bit of an experiment that we're going to try doing. And if it ends up working out, we may do more of it in the future. A couple of months back, Jared posted an article on Trek Movie detailing, I believe, it was, what was it, Jared?
It was for Memorial Day. It was an article about interesting episodes pertaining to the red shirt cliche.
Right. And in the midst of it, Jared wrote a little bit of a blurb about The Changeling, which is a second season episode of the original series. And he wrote it in a way that kind of ruffled my feathers. What exactly did you write, Jared?
I made just a little throwaway reference where I said that The Changeling tells basically the same story as the motion picture, but it's way better.
Yes, which I took exception to and, you know, thought about challenging Jared to a duel over such an insult. But
Which is, to be honest, part of the fandom, right? I would not want to be part of this fandom if we didn't have these kind of discussions.
Right. So Jared and I basically thought at one point we were going to write this up as a long article. And then we thought it might be cool to do as an audio debate and maybe as a prelude to a possible Trek movie podcast. Now, whether we do that or not remains to be seen, but we wanted to try this out and get a feel for it and then maybe get feedback from the readership and see how you guys feel about it. We actually attempted to do this while we were in Vegas for the convention, but time just got the better of us. We were very, very busy while we were there. So, Jared, your thesis was basically that The Changeling covers the same ground as TMP, but does it in a far more entertaining way. Is that correct?
Yes. It's basically similar idea. Just sort of the plot in summary is it's very connected to the two ideas of sort of Gene Roddenberry's secular humanism and sort of confidence for the American space race in the 1960s. And so we have this probe that's gone out. It's been connected with some other intelligence, and it returns to humanity, but problems ensue. You could probably summarize it better than that, but that's sort of how I'd say it.
No. That's big, and there's definitely parallels between the two. There's no question. I mean, it's undeniable. There are a lot of parallels. If you watch, particularly, I watched The Changeling again a couple of days ago just to get a refresher, and there's a lot of similarities between them. But my feeling is that TMP does a far better job conveying the themes surrounding it. The notions of identity and trying to find our place in the universe. It just feels like they took the themes, they took the basic plot line and expanded it in such a way that it became more about us and less about the machine itself.
Okay.
I guess that would be my best way of saying it. Like, to me, V'ger is suffering from a case of identity crisis, and V'ger is not the only character in that movie suffering from that. It's also Spock is suffering from it, Kirk is suffering from it, and Decker to some degree is suffering from it.
To me,
V'ger is used as a springboard to discuss very human feelings. Like Spock says, you know, V'ger has knowledge that spans this universe, and yet with all its pure logic, it's, you know, barren and cold, and that logic and knowledge are not enough. Like, those are heady kind of themes that I don't feel like The Changeling digs into at all. To me, The Changeling always came across as this very kind of middling second season episode of the original series. Like, to me, it's more of like a monster movie.
Oh, sure. And Nomad is kind of a monster of the week type of thing.
Yeah, that's the way it always felt to me. And, like, it just, like, I don't feel like they cover any kind of... I never quite understood what the overarching theme of that episode was, to be perfectly honest. Like, I don't, what do we learn by the end of that episode?
Well, one of the things that I'm particularly interested in this discussion is to hear more of your idea for why you like the motion picture as much as you do. Because I think, you know, you say it's a middling second season episode. I don't think most people would disagree with you. It's certainly not a Journey to Babel or a Mock Time or a piece of the action that's iconic and beloved. I don't think you encounter a lot of Nomad-related cosplay the way you do with maybe some other more popular episodes. And so one of the reasons I said that is, in my article, is I don't think either of these installments are particularly popular. But I know that you really like the motion picture, so I wanted to hear more of your sort of a premise on behalf of it.
Okay. I always thought that the movie has gotten a raw deal over the years, and I get why. I mean, obviously, it's got a very deliberate pace, and that can turn a lot of people off. I know that some people don't like the way the characters are written. They find them very stiff and cold. I think that that movie says it's one of the few movies, in fact, it's the only movie in the entire movie canon that actually attempts to do true science fiction.
I agree. Yeah, I completely agree.
That alone I found very interesting about it. And also, from a character standpoint, it's a huge movie for Spock. I mean, Spock, at the beginning of the movie, when he's, when we first see him, he's going through this culinary ritual where he's basically doing what I would consider a very immature thing, where he's just trying to completely eradicate half of who he is.
Sure.
Because it makes him uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And I, his journey throughout the movie, where he basically comes face to face with something that has actually achieved that pure logic, and when Spock sees it, it repulses him. When he says that logic and knowledge are not enough, that's a huge watershed moment for the character.
Yeah. And there's an echo to that in The Undiscovered Country, where Valeris is talking about logic, and he interrupts her and says, logic is the beginning of wisdom, not the end of it.
Right. And that's something I think he learned from his mind meld with V'ger after he saw what pure logic actually looks like. I just find the movie's issues of identity and finding out, you know, wanting to find out who we are and why we're here, to be a very heady idea.
Yeah, it is.
When they're on the bridge in the director's cut of the movie, when Spock is crying and he basically says, you know, each of us at some time in our lives turns to someone and asks, why am I here?
Yeah.
I think that we all at some point in our lives wonder that. So I feel like that those kinds of themes really hit home.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things about TMP I actually like, but that's definitely one of the things that really grabs me.
And how would you speak to the idea of like Roddenberry's secular humanism coming in there? Because Spock specifically says, we reach out to a parent, a teacher, or a god. And, you know, Roddenberry, I don't know if he was atheist, but he definitely wasn't, you know, didn't subscribe to any traditional Western religion. So how would you speak to that with Roddenberry's sort of metaphysical cosmic view of the universe coming through in that movie?
I thought that was very cool, actually. To me, like, TMP is one of... There are only a handful of instances in the Star Trek canon where Gene was allowed to kind of truly explore what he was really interested in without much interference, and TMP is one of those things.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody would argue that Star Trek The Motion Picture is very much a Gene Roddenberry creation. The notion of transcendence and moving into a higher level. Yeah, that is definitely it's more of a spiritual connection, I think, than a, I don't know, Jared, it's kind of an interesting question.
You're definitely right that the changeling doesn't speak to any of those kind of issues, right? So that's something I hadn't thought about. And so I appreciate your insight on it. I think the main theme of the changeling, which is odd because the it kind of fits into the title but not perfectly well, is this theme that is prevalent in a lot of Star Trek of no matter how good technology becomes, it will never be able to replace human ingenuity. And so one of the things that I love about it is the way that Kirk is able to outwit Nomad, and we see... No, I think I've got it up on Memory Alpha here, the little speech he gives where Nomad says, you're the creator. And he says, no, you're wrong. Jackson Roykirk, your creator, is dead. You've mistaken me for him, and you're an error. You did not discover your mistake. You've made two errors. You are flawed and imperfect. You have not corrected by sterilization. You've made three errors. And so he sends him into this logic feedback loop. And to me, I think that's one of like the prevalent themes throughout all of Star Trek. So... technology has become a part of our life in a way that it wasn't in the 60s and wasn't even in the 90s, right? And so it would be interesting to see Star Trek continue to explore that idea of technology versus human ingenuity. And honestly, there's an episode of Next Generation that does this, but I think it does it more charmingly and a little better, called Booby Trap. They just talked about it a few weeks ago on Mission Log, where Geordi is trying to figure out how to get the Enterprise out of this booby trap, and they say, just let the computer take over. It can do it, but humans can't. And they realize, no, we need to shut everything off and just go off of one thruster, and then the captain flying the ship himself. And so I think that's such a great theme throughout all of Star Trek, and it's obviously not as deep as what you're describing, but it's something that appeals to me, and I think appeals to a lot of people, and is done extremely well and with a lot of charm in The Changeling.
Agreed. But I guess one of the things that about The Changeling that, yes, I agree with what you're saying, but also that is, it is, you have to agree, another instance of Kirk talking a computer to death. I mean, let's face it, he talked several machines to death during the course of the original series.
That's true.
But the M5, he gets that computer to basically shut itself down. Landru, you know, that is one of the TOS tropes, Kirk talking a computer to death.
Yeah.
I mean, there is a certain, there is a certain distrust of technology in the original series. There's no question. As much as it's about high technology, it's also kind of a, there is, I guess, like you said, because it was the 1960s and the computers were still an abstract concept to a lot of people, maybe that's why it's a hallmark of the time. I don't know.
Yeah, and so it would be interesting to see that same kind of idea today, now that we have technology that can do... the technology that you and I have access to today can do more, except for traveling faster than light or whatever, than the technology that Kirk and Spock had access to.
I know, it's incredible. It really is. That's a whole other discussion, just showing how much influence Star Trek had on our everyday lives now. It's remarkable.
Oh, sure. And the classic example was always the fact that when cell phones were first invented, they incorporated the flip technology. Like, unconsciously, we just said that's what these things are supposed to look like. Anyway, we're kind of digressing a little bit. But, you know, in terms of the theme of The Changeling and the broader theme of Star Trek, that's something that I wanted to bring up. Now, one question that I had for you is why I think some people are turned off by what you said about Spock's arc. As good as it is I think people don't like how cold he is for most of the movie. Because he shows up on the Enterprise and everyone wants to, you know, McCoy says, I don't believe it, I'm actually happy to see you. And he's just so cold and distant toward them. And sure, that's part of what he's doing, but I think it rubs fans the wrong way. Because they were excited to see him too. And especially, you know, in 1977, if you haven't seen him except for a few cartoons for 8 years, you're excited to see Spock. You want to, you know, hug him. And then he gives you the cold shoulder. Do you think that's one reason why maybe people don't like a motion picture?
That could. Oh, by the way, it's 79.
79. Did I say 77?
Let's cover that now, because we will be corrected. We will be corrected. So let's just get that out of the way.
Yeah, it's 10 years. Sorry.
I think, look, I did see TMP when it came out.
Oh, nice.
But I was 6 years old, so I didn't really have the mindset to compare it to anything else. I could see why fans would be turned off by that movie when they first saw it. I could totally see why. I mean, you've been waiting 10 years, and that you get this very deliberately paced 2001-type meditation on the universe when, you know, all you want to see is a brand new, exciting adventure of the Starship Enterprise. I get why people didn't care for the movie. I do think, though, when you remove the expectations of that movie, like, you know, in a rearview mirror now, it's been, what, 36 years, I think, since that movie came out. I think if you remove the expectations from it and just view it on its own, I think the movie holds up better.
Oh, okay.
I guess it just, like I said, now that the expectations from the movie have been removed and it can stand more on its own, I think people should re-examine it and see what is in there instead of what's not in there.
Okay.
I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. I think one thing where, or in terms of the what you're describing of being able to look at it apart from when it first came out, and with those expectations removed, I think a missed opportunity with motion picture was when they came out with it on VHS, which was the first time I saw it. rather than abridging some of those really long, ponderous scenes, they added even more material. And so you took the cliche Star Trek, the motionless picture,
right,
and you reinforced it.
Right.
Which turned people off and made it harder for them to want to swallow some of those issues you're talking about.
Yeah, that was because Paramount had added all of those, all that footage back in for the premiere of the movie on ABC, I believe, in 1983, to turn it into like a four-hour spectacular or something. And that was done without Robert Wise's participation. So those scenes are basically thrown back in willy-nilly. In fact, there's a scene in there when Kirk goes chasing after Spock, when Spock leaves the Enterprise.
Oh, sure, yeah. Oh, and they didn't have the effects done.
Around William Shatner.
Yeah.
Because they never finished the shot. But they included it in this extended version. And Robert Wise was never happy about that. Because, you know, he basically just took all the scenes that were lying around and threw them in, whether they needed to be there or not.
Sure.
So, yeah, it increased the running time of the movie, I believe, an extra 11 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a lot. But the plus side of that is it threw back in that Spock crying scene.
Which is integral.
Which is integral, and I cannot believe was ever taken out of the movie to begin with.
Yeah.
Because it basically sums up the movie in a very succinct way.
You know, you might have more insight onto this, but when they filmed Unification and Spock does the mind meld with Picard at the very end, they had originally filmed it, so that it spins around and you can see him crying, but then they cut that out.
Well, you could see Spock as being emotional when he...
Oh, sure. But I don't think there are any tears in the version that we saw.
No, I guess they thought that might be too jarring for the fans. I don't know.
Might have been. I think it would have fit just the same way it did with this.
Okay. I would have liked to have seen them go further with what Spock's transformation was like after his mind meld with V'ger. Because Spock is a different character after that.
Yes, he is. Yeah.
But for the most part in the movies, he's still fairly rigidly Vulcan. He's not... Maybe not as ice cold as he was at the beginning of the movie, but you don't see him incorporate as much of his humanity as maybe you could have.
Okay.
If he's going to become this person who is now more accepting of his dual nature, you would think he would, I don't know, smile more.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. We never really see, we do not see him smile.
Getting back to what I was saying about that is a watershed moment for that character. And I never quite understood why Leonard Nimoy didn't like the movie, because there's so much Spock stuff in that movie.
You know, and in a larger way, you could say like the entire like movie franchise is more about Spock than it is about Kirk.
Yes, absolutely.
Especially in Voyage Home and Undiscovered Country. I mean, Spock is driving the action in all of it, and Kirk's just along for the ride.
Yep, absolutely.
To the point where there's that scene at the end of Voyage Home where it's at the very end where Kirk has to like go underwater and free the whales by hand. And I think Leonard Nimoy inserted that scene so that his star wouldn't realize he wasn't the star. Does that make sense?
Interesting.
And I mean, of course, they are friends and they had respect for each other. Right. But like Spock's the one who comes up with the idea for the whale. Spock's the one who comes up with the idea for going back in time. Scotty's the one who comes up with the idea for the transparent aluminum. And Kirk doesn't even get the girl, right?
I know. And the look on Kirk's face when he doesn't get the girl is priceless.
It's terrific. Oh, so the one along those lines, while we're talking about Spock's broader arc that starts in the motion picture, there's a line in The Final Frontier, which I know a lot of people don't like, where he says to Cybok, I'm no longer the outcast boy you knew on Vulcan. I've found my place.
I know who I am.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you could say that Spock learned a lot of that from his mind meld with V'ger.
Yeah, that's where he starts. That's where he was able to do that.
No, that's true. I hadn't thought of that. But, yeah, you can make that connection easily. Absolutely.
Yeah. To the point where I mean, if you look at the where Final Frontier comes, it doesn't really make much sense between Voyage Home and Undiscovered Country. But if they'd done it after the motion picture, I think it would have fit a little bit better.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about Kirk's adventure in the motion picture. Because something that, and of course you know the movie much better than I do, something that kind of rubs me a little bit the wrong way is the way Kirk can't just be a desk jockey and he needs to hijack the mission from Decker.
Right.
Is this portrayed as a flaw in Kirk, or is this portrayed as something that needs to do because he's got his big admiral pants on and Decker doesn't?
Oh, I think it's definitely an ego thing. I don't think he's aware of what's driving him. That's why McCoy calls him out later. Kirk doesn't seem to be aware of what he's doing, but what Kirk does to Decker is really messed up.
Yeah, it is.
He basically ruins his career.
Yeah. To the point where Decker essentially commits suicide at the end?
He kind of, I think, just realizes that he's got nothing left for him. He's not anywhere near as obsessive and driven as the guy who's captain of the Enterprise, and he just decides to go in a new direction. Although, in the novelization of the film that Gene Roddenberry wrote, you learn a lot more about who Decker is and what drives him and why he made that choice to go and become part of V'ger. But that's not in the movie, so you kind of left it to make your own suppositions about why he made that decision at the end. But I think Kirk basically pushing him out of the way definitely was driving him.
Now, is it established in the movie or is it in the novelization that Decker is the son of Commodore Decker from the Doomsday Machine?
It's in the novelization. I don't think it's, and it might have been in the Phase 2 Writer's Bible.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
But it's not mentioned in the movie at all. Yeah, because Decker is a Phase 2 character that was born into the movie.
Because I'd always had that in my mind that they were related. And so part of Decker's frustration with Kirk may stem from the fact that he might blame Kirk for his father's death in some way or another.
Yeah.
Is that too much of a jump?
Well, it's not explicitly mentioned in the novel, but I mean, you could easily make that connection. But no, in the novel, it's almost basically mentioned in passing that he's Matt Decker's son.
Oh, okay.
It's not, nothing is made of it. It's just more notated than anything.
Oh, interesting. Just sort of a little way to tie it back to the original series.
Yeah, that's all. That's all.
Rather than establish a character arc.
Right. And I think the idea, too, is you don't want to refer too far back to the original series for people who maybe had not seen the episode. So you don't really want to make a big deal out of it.
Sure.
You know, the average person is not going to remember, A, the Doomsday Machine, and B, who the hell Matt Decker was.
It's certainly not as significant as the fact that Khan was marooned on City Alpha 5.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. But getting back to Kirk's motivations, yeah, the character, he's very much lost at the beginning of the movie. He's like Spock in his own. The characters, the two main characters, are basically lost at the beginning of the movie. Kirk took a job that he clearly does not want, and whether he's aware of it or not, is willing to step on a lot of people in order to correct the mistake that he made, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't appear to be completely aware that he's doing it, because it takes McCoy chewing him out for him to realize exactly what he was doing.
In terms of his bull in a china shop approach to command.
Yeah, he calls, McCoy says to him, he goes, "You're obsessed." He goes, "You're completely obsessed." And Kirk kind of jerks his head like he didn't, like he didn't even see that.
See, that's sort of where his arc for Wrath of Khan starts, in my opinion, because we have that callback in the scene on Kirk's birthday where he says, "You're flying a damn computer console when you want to be out hopping galaxies."
Yeah. There's a whole thing about, this is a little bit off topic, but when it comes to like Kirk and the Admiralty, I never understood why he was an admiral again at the beginning of the Wrath of Khan, chafing at being at a desk. You'd figure once he got away and basically saved the Earth, there was no way in hell he was going to go back to the Admiralty and become a teacher at Starfleet Academy.
Sure.
I never quite understood why they put him back in the Admiral's, at an Admiral's desk at the beginning of the Wrath of Khan. Because it kind of just ignores what had transpired in the previous film.
Yeah, I think part of that is the TV mindset of hitting the reset button.
Yeah.
And even more stupefying, perhaps, than what you're describing there is the fact that Riker stayed Picard's first officer instead of getting his own ship for 7 years after the 1701D was destroyed.
Yeah. Yeah. You could make a lot of, you could make a lot of arguments about the quote unquote realism of the Star Trek franchise as far as like the characters and their motivations. I mean, Kirk's crew basically stay with him for 3 decades.
Yeah. Which, like if you look at the closing shot of Undiscovered Country, Chekhov has not moved in terms of his career.
Well, he did. He was on the Reliant.
But then, he becomes a security chief, and then he goes over to the Reliant, but then he basically just comes back.
Right. They all kind of just, for the most part, they all kind of just decide to spend their entire careers with Kirk. And even if they wanted to, a military organization would not allow that.
No.
No, but that is like a whole other conversation about the kind of, for all the quote, the arguments that Star Trek fans like to make about the realism of Star Trek, that kind of thing is not, kind of pokes holes in the whole realism argument. These characters would not spend decade after decade together on one ship.
No, from that perspective, the only series that realistically portrays a career in a military-type organization would be Voyager, because you have a group of people who can't be transferred.
Right.
Okay, just, if this is it, I'm on Memory Alpha right now, I'm reading that they have a specific mention about Kirk talking computers to death. The technique is also used in The Return of the Archons, iMUD, The Ultimate Computer, and something similar in What Are Little Girls Made Of? So out of 78 episodes, we have 5 of them that involve Kirk talking to computers.
That's a lot. Yeah, that, like I said, it's a trope. It's a TOS trope. It definitely is.
Yeah.
And it's fine. Like I said, it makes sense for that time period that the series was made in. That the computers were mostly, to the general public, the viewing audience, computers were a very foreign thing.
Sure.
Threatening thing. I mean, to some degree, they're still threatening to a lot of people today, but then much more so.
Yeah.
Back in the days when computers were filling entire rooms, so it makes sense that they would try they would go that route.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And there's even like a line in Space Seed where Khan says, you can create a machine that can do the work of 2 men, but if you improve man, you can do the work of 100 men. And it's like, well, I think, Khan, you've actually got that reversed.
That's true.
Like, advances in technology can do so much more.
Interesting.
But, that fits with Khan's arrogant view of himself.
Yes, of course.
It's very internally consistent.
Right, absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh, okay, the one last thing, and this kind of returns to a little bit of what I said before, is I do think, motion picture may be unappreciated. It may be made fun of for being too long. Like I used that line before, the motionless picture. But it is essential for setting up Wrath of Khan.
Oh, absolutely.
Couldn't have just gone into Wrath of Khan after nothing but the cartoons for, at that point, it would have been 13 years.
You need to find out where the characters had been and what they were doing. And
yeah. Yes. Because we can't just be catapulted into Kirk's midlife crisis without seeing where his career has progressed. We can't just go into seeing Spock die without having some setup for the character and coming to know him and love him again.
Right.
And we need to see sort of the crew in one form or another brought back together.
Right.
Which is what that does.
Right. Yeah, it absolutely does that. And like I said, could it have been more of a less rigid movie, the first movie, and could it have felt more like the original series? Yeah, probably. But that's not the movie that they were trying to make.
No. And you say they were trying to make something that was like 2001.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely got – it's a cold movie. It's not as ice cold as 2001. But it's a cold, clinical movie in many ways. It's very restrained.
Yeah.
Gene, one thing that I've learned from reading Mark Cushman's books on the original series, These Are the Voyages, is that Gene did not particularly like a lot of humor in Star Trek.
Oh, really? I didn't realize that.
That's become very clear in these books that Cushman wrote, that Gene felt that he didn't like that Gene Coon had added so much humor with the Trouble with Tribbles and a piece of the action. He felt they were too broad. So the fact that the motion picture is almost, I mean, there are a few moments of levity here and there, but for the most part, the motion picture is very serious.
Yep.
And that's Gene, all Gene in many ways. And to some degree, Robert Wise, who himself is a bit restrained. It doesn't surprise me in retrospect now that the movie is very, very serious.
I'm trying to think of jokes in the movie. The only ones I can think of are at the very end when Kirk says, warp speed, that-a-way, or something like that.
Yeah, that, and when Spock walks into the officer's lounge and McCoy goes, you know, Spock, you haven't changed a bit. You're just as warm and sociable as ever. And Spock goes back to him and basically says, nor have you, Doctor, as your continued predilection for irrelevancy demonstrates. Like, that's like, but that's like one of the few moments of true humor in the movie. DeForest Kelly, you know, always got the best lines anyway. So
yeah, of course. Of course. And just the view of him with that big crazy beard is pretty funny too.
Yeah, he looks like he came straight from, like, I don't know, some party in like some groovy commune in the 70s or something.
Yeah, I think
he's got the chest hair coming out, he's got the big beard, he's like wearing a leisure suit. It's like such a 70s.
Yep. He was at a space key party.
Yeah.
There's also a line in there where one of the junior crewmen is like, thinks it's weird that Kirk is taking over for Captain Decker, and Uhura says, our chances of success may have just doubled. And like, that's kind of a little wisecrack, but it reinforces something that makes me kind of uncomfortable to be watching, which is Kirk, you know, just bowling over his junior officer. Because in a lot of ways, I watch that movie and the person I identify with is the Decker character.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, because he's the outsider, right? We have this pre-established sort of family, and then he's the one who's introduced it to it. I don't know if you could say he's like a surrogate for the fans, but he's just... He knows what he's doing, but he's powerless to people who just happen to be older than him. Maybe I saw that as a younger person. I mean, I remember one time, this when this job I had, and I was in a room with the guy who'd been hired to be my boss. This is when I was in the Senate. The guy I'd hired to be my boss, the legislative director and the chief of staff, and we're talking about some communication strategy. And I'm like, I'm the one who knows what to do here, but I make way less money than all of these guys. What's... You know, but that's just part of life, right? And so I think that...
Especially when you're young.
Of course, which, you know, when I first saw it was when I was younger. If I watch it again now, I might identify with Sulu, who's fumbling over this hot girl who's way out of his league. Which is, of course, a much more amusing anecdote now, given George.
In the closet. But that's an interesting viewpoint, Jared. I had never thought of it that way. There is a certain subtext to it, though, too, that the fact that, I mean, Kirk may have wanted command back, but it was Admiral Nagura who allowed him to take command back, which almost kind of betrays a certain level of no confidence in Decker from his superiors. So, I mean, there's other ways of reading into it as well, that, you know, Decker is a very young, inexperienced starship captain, and they've got this giant entity coming at them, that maybe you do need an experienced hand at the wheel. I don't know. There's all sorts of ways of looking at it. But yes, I can understand what you're saying about the being powerless against
this institution where you may, you know better, but you're not in charge. Like when Kirk wants to use the photon torpedoes and he's like, no, you can't, you get, I'll get corrected, where he wants to use either the phasers or the photon torpedoes at warp and Decker has to stop him because it's linked to the warp drive now.
Right, the phasers won't work.
Yeah, yeah.
When they're in warp speed.
Yeah, that's why they
fire and end up firing the torpedoes. So yes, Kirk doesn't know the ship as well as Decker, but by the same token, though, there are several instances throughout the movie where Decker tries to go with a more conservative approach to the issues, and basically, with the exception of Ilea being obviously chewed up by V'ger, there are several instances where Decker's conservative approach was not the right way to go. And it gets kind of proven several times throughout the movie that he's being a little too cautious when you kind of don't, you're running out of time and you need to, you know, come up with a solution to this. You can't sit there and be careful all the time.
Yeah, yeah. And it does round Kirk's character out in ways that make him more than just kind of a cliche of like a cowboy in space. And I think it does a lot to set up his flaws and his motivations, some of his shortcomings, and again, like, sets it up for this masterpiece that would follow of Kirk dealing with his midlife crisis.
Right.
So thanks everybody for listening to Trek Movie's first foray into podcasting. I want to thank my co-host here, Brian Drew, the Trek expert. If anyone on the Trek Movie staff or the Spock or Data of our group, it's definitely him. He knows these things backwards and forwards. Well, maybe I'm like the sort of Chief O'Brien who's just trying to do his best and just doesn't want to get shot at. and Kayla is, of course, whatever character she wants to be.
That's right. Yeah, so we will, depending on the feedback we get from this, try to do this again, hopefully with Kayla the next time.
That would be a good idea.
Kayla is away at the moment, so she's not part of this. Thank you very much, everybody. And we'll talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon. Thanks, Brian.
Bye-bye.